How good does it get, SK?
Why not us, Charlie?
Today, live from the Pinecrest Inn, it's The Smiley Show. So long, everybody.
This is The Smiley Show.
All right, happy to be welcomed in by Mark Blackburn, who makes his home in Birmingham, Alabama. And Mark, congratulations is in order. Of course, the PGA coach for Justin Rose and many other pros. But that had to be fun to watch at Torrey Pines, watching Justin Rose just dust the field, Mark.
Yeah, no, exciting. That's the first time I've had a wire-to-wire winner, and obviously the scoring record's unbelievable. So usually you're stressing, and then when someone's got that big a lead, now it's like, okay, well, seven shots. I mean, can I actually go do something? Can I go to the store, and is he still going to be leading? So I actually went to Whole Foods, was doing some shopping, and I'm like, okay, well, he's still going. I'm like, okay. So it was actually interesting when I talked to him last night, because that's the first. I've never had that. So it was very impressive. His prep was really good. My wife said, "Oh, who's playing well this week?" I said, "Well, Rosie's in a really good spot." So it was interesting, like how it all transpired.
You know, things were going well, and as a PGA coach, I imagine you're constantly following the PGA Tour leaderboards on your phone, on the app, and so it had to be nice to have that wire to wire. And you talked about those errands, running to Whole Foods. You even dropped off a book to my house. This is a new book by Mark Blackburn, The Coaching Code. We'll talk a little bit more about this later, but that's even better when on a Sunday at 4 p.m. when you drop this book off, that you're not even having to watch. You could even just listen to SiriusXM in the car and just be like, you know what, this thing is on ice. That's quite the win.
I wish they were all like that. Usually they're not. They're all nail biters. So I generally don't watch anything until the back nine on Sunday. I tell all my players, the goal is to put you in position on the back nine on Sunday. And so That's whatever happens, my wife Melissa's big into, like, she keeps up with it. All the players. So she's like, kind of tells you what's going on. I'm like, well, it doesn't matter until Sunday on the back nine anyway. So usually that's when you're into it. So this was very unique, but it's actually quite nice. It's very, not much stress.
How many wins is this for you now, Mark, as a coach on the PGA
Tour? This is going to sound terrible, but I couldn't tell you exactly.
Really? Don't know the number? Yeah. Oh, no. Come on. You have to know the number.
I don't. I can tell you the first one was in 2005 or 2004 with Heath Slocum. I think it's 2005 in Jackson, Mississippi at the Southern Farm Bureau, but I've lost count now. So I guess that's a good sign, right? That you don't remember. It's actually funny because at the academy, I have a stack of flags that I need to get framed to put on the wall. And everyone's laughing. It's like, we need to take these flags down. You've got so many new ones to put up. So I probably need to do that. But I generally couldn't tell you. I've lost count. that's bad. I'm always worried about the next one. To be honest, it's like, I'm like Nick Saban. So what's next, right? Like, okay, I've done that, I'm on to the next one. So you work towards a win, and then you get a win, and then you're like, okay, well, and then the next one. But obviously one guy wins, and then you have four or five others that didn't win, and they're headless, and the guy that wins is like euphoric, and then it's on to
always.
The next one.
Always. It's one thing to the next as a coach. You get that win with a player, but the other players, you know, sometimes are working through things. It's never quite as easy as it always feels, but it sure had to feel that way on Sunday. And of course, the Blackburn Golf Academy in Birmingham, Alabama at Greystone, crunchy club. I've spent a bunch of time out there, been out there with you as well. And I actually do remember the flag signed by Heath Slocum in there. It probably was that 2005 win, which I'm sure was a sweet one for you, making your name in the teaching world, Mark. You know, getting that first big break when you started coaching in 1999 and finally get on you know, a good player in Heath Slocum, where he was kind of struggling, but you found something, and 17 out of 18 made cuts later. You're now a winning coach on the PGA Tour. What did that feel like at the time, and did it feel like it was your first big break?
Yeah, no, for sure. I tell everybody it was like a Willy Wonka golden ticket moment, right? So I was really lucky. DJ Nelson, who we played mini tours together, he went to South Alabama when I was at Southern Miss. Then we traveled. I was the best man in his wedding. He was the best man in my wedding. And then he was Heath's caddy at the time, and Heath was struggling. And then, you know, naive and young, probably wouldn't happen now. DJ's like, well, why don't you let Mark's teach you? Why don't you let Mark help you? And Heath and I knew each other really well from mini tour days. So I guess that was before the, you know, the internet, Instagram, and any of those other things. So there was a shortage of information, and it's kind of the stars aligned. And so that was definitely my big break. And he was my first guy. And then I rolled that into other, Robert Carlson was kind of my second big guy. And so it's just, it's one of those things. If you do a good job and you're around, you kind of pick up other players. And once people see that you're into what you do and you're pushing players, you tend to get more clients. And it's like anything, success breeds success. But it was a interesting start, but again, look, you got to take what you can get. So very fortunate. It's just a crazy game.
Oh, 100%. You're a player first. So when I think about even my journey, Mark, and getting into media, I never, ever would have expected that I would be having a podcast or calling golf on TV. I was just always a golfer. And so for you, as somebody who also was a golfer, did you ever see yourself getting into instruction? And did you ever find yourself thinking about instruction at a higher level at an earlier age?
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. So obviously, I wanted to play golf. Like, I grew up in England. I came to America on a scholarship because my aspiration was to play the European Tour. And then once I got to America, it was like the PGA Tour. And I think I'd always had kind of this affinity for like the swing and coaching and teaching and tinkering is probably the best way to say it. That's probably, which is a dangerous road to go, right? So I think my aspirations to play were probably derailed a little bit by wanting to understand things. And I, at the time, the information we have now is incredible. There's so many different disciplines that all go into coaching and teaching. And at the time, it really wasn't like that. And so the problem is, when I was trying to play, it was like, oh, you need to do this, you need to do this. And I spent so much time on the range trying to get this perfect technique. I mean, it was a bit of a running joke on the Hooters Tour. You get all these players and I'd still be on the range. I'd have all these trinkets and props. So it probably was in the stars that was what was going to happen. But I think that also probably helped me in a way, because the players I ended up coaching who went onto the tour, who, you know, we'd sort of come up through the Hooters Tour together. They went on to the buy.com at the time and then the tour. They saw that was my passion early and I was really interested in it. So I think that created this sort of trust factor and it definitely helped me. But no, my aspirations were to play. I got injured. And I think that, along with not having great information, kind of was this perfect storm for falling into coaching and teaching. And I think I wanted to stay in the game. My college degree was exercise science and coaching. So I kind of had some of that anyway. And then I kind of put some pieces together and it kind of transpired into teaching and coaching. And I love it. I mean, I think it's a lot of fun pushing people. I really enjoy the coaching part, like try to help people do things they didn't think were possible. And that's kind of where probably my niche is. I'm not the guy who's going to work with 50 people and that's just not my style. I'd rather have, you know, a handful of guys and really try and push them and develop them and get them to be the best players they can be. And so it's a lot of fun. I really enjoy it, but it isn't where I saw myself. I definitely, my aspirations were to be, have the name on the bag and be hitting the shots, not standing in the background watching. I tell everyone I have the coldest profession ever, or the hottest, depending on where you are. I watch divots for a living.
I have vivid memories, Mark. When I was a kid, I took from Eric Ashman out of Country Club of Birmingham, of course, is rising up the ranks, eventually going to be the president of the PGA of America. And he taught me so much at an early age, just first off, how to love the game, but also great mechanics. And there was one year in which he brought you or invited you over to Country Club of Birmingham to host, maybe it was a junior clinic of some sorts, but I remember thinking, who's this guy coming from Gunnersville? But also, why does he have a funny accent that isn't a Gunnersville accent? Do you remember when this would have been? And I'm just trying to like jog my own memory here.
It would probably be, I think it might be early 2000s. It would probably be around.
So pre-Heath.
Yeah. I think it would probably be 01, 02, probably. Maybe it was a bit later than that. I'm not sure. But yeah. I think it would be early doors. Eric's always been a great friend. He's a good mentor. So, yeah. And then he has a factory of juniors there at
factory.
BCC.
It's an understatement. Understatement. You had us, Mark, I remember, on maybe the putting green or the chipping green. You're like, all right, everybody, I want you to close your eyes and balance on one leg. And everybody's falling all over themselves. But I remember thinking that at the time, I was like, I'm an athlete. Like, I'm the best at whatever sport I've played at this point. I can't do this. What do you think from a junior golf perspective? What were you trying to, whether it was learn about just athletic motion and juniors to develop them at an early age, to try to take what they do, whether it's on the football field, the soccer field, basketball court, and into golf, in a sport where you're stagnant, but you're moving and trying to hit a little ball that won't listen?
Yeah, I mean, I think golf traditionally, you've had a lot of kids that were, they tried everything else and they weren't very good at it. So it's one of those things when you do clinics, I'm always keen to see who are the best athletes. Like you're trying to sort of figure out who are who's who. And balance is something that the best athletes, as soon as you ask them to balance and close their eyes, they're like, after about 10 seconds, like, what's the point of this? Whereas people who aren't quite as coordinated are falling all over the place. So I think it's one of those things, like functional movement and then really functional fundamental movement skills are really important. So in our kids at Greystone and our development programs, our PDEF programs, it's all about, we want to be an athlete, give them, you know, physical literacy, we call it, and then start to develop some of the skills. So like when you're doing those clinics, it more of it's to try and create a little bit of fun initially, but then there's always a bit of a method to the madness in it, trying to get, figure out of who's good, who's not. And when you generally have a group of people, you're trying to figure out, okay, well, I can do something with these ones over here need to do this. So it's generally like you're just kids. The best thing about kids, they're a sponge. And you're really trying to figure out, you know, you're identifying the talent early, and your athleticism is such a big indicator of that.
Okay, so Gunners Landing, Gunnersville, Alabama, big lake. So maybe there's some people that listen to this show that are like, oh yeah, I might have fished there, or I went to a lake house there before. For you, how do you describe this town and just what your memories are of being the coach there for 14 years?
Yeah, Gunnersville's been great to me. My wife, Melissa's from there. Two of my sort of original sponsors are from there, Alan Walker and a bunch of other folks. But I mean, Gunnersville was great. It was a really good place to like basically travel from. I had a great setup. I mean, the driving range was a ski slope. It looks over the lake. It's one of the most picturesque driving ranges you've ever seen. But it's downhill with short flight golf balls, which is quite interesting. But it was one of those things where it gave me a platform where I could travel all over. I could go see different people. And I was in a position where I worked at the golf course and was teaching, but then I could also go travel and see other coaches. And I was basically, the way it worked out, my wife was teaching dance and she was like, you need to go do whatever you can to educate yourself before we have kids or whatever. And so that's what I would do. And I'd go see a lot of different people. So I kind of started off in the golf machine world. Then I went into Mac O'Grady, and then I just started to see a bunch of different people. And then in the mid 2000s, I kind of spent some time with Greg Rose at TPI, and that kind of then nurtured into the stuff I'd done in college. And you put all the golf machine, lots of different ways to swing the club with physical assessments, and now all of a sudden you got different ways to swing the club and different patterns. And I would say one of the things I'm probably proudest of is the guys I coach, not one of them looks the same. All girls, right? They all have different patterns. And I think I've got a bit of a, I guess, a reputation now of being a bit like Harvey Keitel in Pulp Fiction, Mr. Wolf, fix it, right? So if somebody's like kind of a little messed up, or they've struggled with something, they're coming off an injury, hey, agents seem to call me, and that's what seems to happen. But I like that, right? It's one of those things where you kind of have to be authentic and be good at what you do to be able to help people, especially when they've been struggling. And so it's a fun, I like underdog stories. I'm a big fan of someone tells me they can't do something. I kind of like to push players and make them see things in themselves they can't. I mean, when Berger came to me, Steiny asked me to see Berger. Berger came to me, I think, in 23, I believe. And his club speed, he's been on his back for 2 years. His club speed was, it may have been late 23, early 24. His club speed with the driver was like 103, 104. Ben Shearer had got him off the couch, done an amazing job with him. And then this week, he's sending me texts that he's of screenshots of his TrackMan with his driver at like 122, 186 ball speed. So it's one of those things.
What?
Where 186 ball speed. 186
Daniel
ball speed.
Berger's hitting 186 ball speed. Yeah. Come on, Berger.
He's fast. So again, it's things like that. But that's kind of I would say that's the thing I really enjoy. That's why I wrote this book. Like, I like the coaching part and getting people to do things they didn't think were possible. That's one of the most gratifying things with Rosie. He was kind of, he got to number one, struggling. COVID was terrible for everybody. And for Rosie, he didn't really have access to anybody. So it was really difficult for him. And obviously he had a great run with Sean, and then they couldn't see each other. It was because of COVID. And then Rosie started tinkering and he kind of all went sideways. But when I got with him, I was like, Rosie, I still think you've got some really good golf left. I think you need to change a few things, maybe go back to some things you used to do. Mm-hmm. And obviously we've kind of seen where he's gone. So I would say I really enjoy that part of it. I think that's a lot of fun. So developing juniors and then taking problems, struggling players and trying to help them, I think is a lot of fun.
You know, it's so nice to be able to go back and look at old videos, or, you know, now being able to take data from something you've recorded of a swing years ago and be able to cross-check it versus how you're swinging now. Going all the way back to when you began in teaching, Mark, and looking at where the technology is now, at the beginning, were you one that was kind of pushing boundaries when it came to the technology? Where for the longest time, I think my dad, you know, he went to all these coaches as well, and it was all of these, you know, whether it was, you know, golf machine type stuff, but all of it was like feel stuff, not a ton of video, all just like basic things that the eyes can see. But do you feel like you really started to push the boundaries of technology earlier? And did that, do you think that helped you kind of advance in this career faster?
Yeah, no, for sure. I think one of the things you have to do is, as you're young, and traditionally golf instruction has definitely been, we had gurus, you had like Butch, you had David Ledbetter, Chuck Cook, Jim McClain, Mike Adams, you had all these like amazing teachers and coaches. And they'll, in order to fast track yourself, you basically had to use technology to learn, to figure things out. And obviously those guys are really, really successful and probably were not embracing of technology as much as, say, younger people were. So the best thing about data is it's very objective. So you start to learn and understand what's actually happening. Right. Obviously, 3D motion capture was a massive, massive thing because you started to see, okay, well, video is telling me one thing, but here's actually what's happening and here's the movements that are creating that. And then we got into ground reaction forces, and obviously we had radar technology, ball launch monitors, and now we've got a very different sort of mindset on the ball flight laws. We start to understand, you know, a lot more club geometry, and then you throw all these things together and all of a sudden it's like, wow. And then you put in the emotional motor learning to all of these other pieces, and you start to actually validate why some of these coaches have been so successful with certain players. Why have they struggled with other players? What are the soft skills that they're so good at? Like the, you know, getting people to do things. Why do people play well when they're in Butch Harmon's presence? What is it he does? Well, he's an incredible motivator, you know, / psychologist. Like that's his superpower. But that's what coaching is, right? So again, there's a lot of what people are incredible at, technology validates. Now, whilst a lot of people might be reluctant and, you know, push it away, when you start to explore, being curious, I think, is really important in the learning field. All of a sudden, you get all these disciplines, you get access to it, and all of a sudden, you can fast track. And I always say technology is for the student to expedite the learning curve. It validates and shows us things as the coach, but at the end of the day, you still have to be someone who has human interaction, right? Like the soft skills are still massively important, but technology allowed me to have a bigger understanding and a better understanding a lot more quickly. However, there's still no substitute for teaching people. And we all learn more from our mistakes than our successes. And obviously the guys that have been coaching for 40, 50 years, they've made lots of errors, but that's where they get their wisdom from. And so that's where, for a young guy, you had to use technology to be able to bypass, you know, some of that experience. There's no substitute for it, but you're trying to fast track it. And so it's one of those things where over time, the technology, I spent way too much money on it. Finally, last year, my wife got a swimming pool, but she'd never had one because all my money would go in towards 3D radars, like teaching tech, right? So it's pretty funny, but we now have a nice pool, so it's great. But
invite me over. I want to come swimming sometime.
But it's one of those things where I kind of invested in that so that I could have the information. And once you have an understanding of technology and you know how to use it, it's seamless. Just like when you go to the doctor and you go to Birmingham's a big medical town, right? You get a lot of testing, diagnostics. It's not invasive. Generally, it's done really, really well. It's the same with coaching. Once you understand the tech, you use it in the right time appropriately, and it's really designed to help the student learn faster. But it, in the long run, it allowed me to have a much bigger knowledge bucket,
right,
so that I can help more people. And so I'm a big proponent of it. When people poo-poo technology, I generally think it's a misunderstanding. They haven't taken the time to learn something and understand it. And once you have, it's massively, it's so, so powerful. I mean, I'd much rather go have surgery at Andrews now than I would 25 years ago. And it's no different in golf instruction, right? So, and the brightest minds, people are really starting to understand how do we help people play the game better on all facets.
I think the great coaches are coaches that understand matchups and golf swings. And you talk about how all of your players swing the golf club differently. Was there a certain matchup that you felt uncomfortable teaching at an earlier point in your career that now you feel like, hey, there isn't anything that I can't coach?
That's a great point. I think if we're all honest, I mean, a lot of times we have preferences, and I think early on you're a byproduct of how you've been indoctrinated and how you've been taught. And so I think at times you've had preferences and you probably felt more comfortable teaching those patterns. But then over time, I think you start to look at things and try and figure out, well, why does that work? And then once you start to be able to measure it, break it down and understand the ingredients, if you like, of that recipe, then it becomes really interesting because every student is somebody who's different and it's an opportunity to work on a different recipe. So now I kind of look at it as a bit of it's a critical thinking challenge, but that's the part I really enjoy. Like, how am I going to figure this out for the shot the person wants to hit, the trajectory, the shape, and then what they're bringing to me are some of the ingredients, and then invariably they're missing some to make the recipe that they want, and I've got to kind of figure out how am I going to do that. So I think now when they're different, it's a really good challenge. I think early on, if it had been something that was complicated, I wouldn't necessarily know what to do. Now I think with time and experience, you're always, you don't really ever panic. You're like, oh, that's interesting. Well, how does that work? Okay. And the funniest part is, I think simplicity is on the other side of complexity. A friend of mine said that to me once, and it's genius. But the reality is, once you start to understand stuff, that's where the fundamentals and the simple setup, the things that seem so mundane are really, really significant because they have such an influence on everything else. And the genius is to figure out what's the one thing that accomplishes so many other things. And I think the likes of Chuck Cook, Randy Smith, Butch Harmon are all really good at that. And you get that with experience. And so I'd say I probably say a lot less now than I used to. But when I do say something, it's probably a lot more conviction. And I'm like, oh, this is what you need to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I even think about a player like Ches Reavy, who you've coached for it feels like forever. If you go look at Ches Reavy's golf swing, and if you've never seen him hit, first off, one of the straightest golf hitters I've ever seen in my entire life, just comes out right in the center every single time. But here's a guy that has all sorts of things going on in his golf swing. And I imagine, you know, maybe a younger self would have seen this golf swing and said, well, I think I know what to do with this, but not really quite sure. When you have something so unique like a Ches Reavy come through the door, like, how nice is it to have that background with, you know, even just in college with your fitness background, working all the way up and having this technology to guide you?
Yeah, no, it's great because you can see the genius of why something works. I think it's always good. You never judge a book by its cover. I always tell everyone the best golfers generally make a really good noise. And then if you just watch the golf ball, it's their ball control and what do they do. And I think we now have a much better appreciation of older swings, like swings going back in the day that tended to look, they were very idiosyncratic. They weren't, you were like, well, that doesn't really look right, but they were great players. And now you can see the genius of how that worked. And I think that's the part that you get when good players come in and they're good ball strikers. Okay, what makes them great? What are they doing? Okay, why does that work? And then you're trying to always do no harm. It's like a medical doctor, like you take an oath, like I'm trying to make you better, but I'm trying to do it without making you worse as well, right? So that's the great part. Like Chez had some great pieces. He was coming back from an injury. It was like, what are some of the adjustments you can make to not get re-injured? Why did you get injured? And I think it's one of those things where you're just trying to always build around what somebody does well. What is the DNA, the nucleus of what they do? Yeah. And you, everybody who gets to the tour is great at something because they're the top 1% of the 1% of golfers around the world. So I think people sometimes forget that, oh, that won't work. Well, if you'd gone back 15 years, people would look at Scottie Scheffler and probably go, that's not going to work. But it's genius. Like if you actually look at it now, a lot of what he does is incredible. And obviously Randy's so wise that he never changed any of it. He just nurtured it. And I think that's the part that's what good coaching is like, how do you get somebody to continue to do things? And I think good athletes tend to, if you like, push the envelope and challenge the norm. And I think a lot of things, when the Frisbee flopped, the first guy to do the high jump this way, everyone thought it was bonkers. Well, now it's the norm, right? So I think all of these things over time, things change, but your understanding of, oh, well, that will work because of this, that definitely takes a higher learning, but that's the fun part. If you got a hammer, everything looks like a nail, but if you got a toolkit, everything is kind of different. You can fix anything, right? And I think that's more, I always liken it a bit to, I used to love the show House on TV, where he, you know, he would basically get everyone right and it would be doing it alternatively and slightly differently. And that's kind of how I like to look at it.
Well, you mentioned Scottie Scheffler, and I quickly have to ask, because I think we can all agree that he's undoubtedly the best ball striker in the game, and what he's able to do with the golf ball day in and day out and execute is phenomenal. I want to ask you, as somebody who's the best coach in the game right now, what is the key ingredient? What is the one thing that you see that makes it work time and time and again for him?
I just think, I know, obviously, Phil Kenyon's a very good friend of mine, and he just talks about how incredible his hands are and his hand-eye coordination. I think, ultimately, he's very diligent with his grip. I've seen him, the shots he hits, I think he's a great athlete playing golf. I don't think he's cluttered. I think he keeps it very simple. I think Randy does an amazing job with that. And his shot making is just phenomenal. Like he plays golf shots, like he hits this sort of lowish, squeezy cut I see a lot. And then he's got a smash shot. Like he always hits the right shot. Like it's like very similar to watching Tiger or Rosie, but he just keeps doing it. And he's a big man too, right? Like yes. He's 6'3", 6'4". And that's what I think people forget. He's got a massively long arc. So he's able to do and hit some shots, which are phenomenal. There's a, you know, upright golf swings have a big advantage that they can generate a lot of speed. He's also very, very accurate. And I think that Randy has nurtured him so well to like play the game. And he's such a competitor. Like when you're around him, he's competitive with everything. Yes. He'd want to play table tennis with you, and he'd want to beat you. And then he'd be say, I'm sorry afterwards. But like in the moment, he's phenomenal. But I think he's got great hands. I think he's got a golf swing that makes a lot of sense. It's got all of the right matchups for him, and his shot making ability is incredible. And he plays the game. At the end of the day, I think Tiger had a very pretty looking golf swing and it was very functional, but he played the game so well. Like tactically, he was so disciplined. Scott Fawcett's decades based on, you know, tracking Tiger shots and how he played was just incredible, very similar to Nicholas. So it's like Scotty plays like that. I think he's got so many shots. He's fearless. And Phil Kenyon's done a great job of getting him putting, unfortunately for the rest of us.
Yes.
But I just think that I think he's an athlete playing golf. I think there's a lot of genius in what he does. I think he's got a phenomenal head on his shoulders. He's got the ultimate competitor mindset, but he's also got a lot of humility and a lot of grace. Like I think he's great for golf, and he's great to watch. Like take videos, show them to my other players. Like he's hitting shots. It's not just the same thing, but I think his hand-eye coordination is probably the best of possibly all the players. Is phenomenal. And I don't know that. I'm just going on what I'm told and my observation.
I could tell you he's very good at pickleball. And he absolutely whooped me. So, and his hand eye was just insane. I was like, what in the world? This guy's good at everything. An incredible athlete. He's like, he was huge at the net. Felt like it was Dirk Nowitzki at the net. Couldn't get it by the guy.
This is what we were originally calling the E9, the emergency nine, but we got a very friendly cease and desist from Colton Ost and Drew Stoltz. So we're now calling it short-sighted. So basically, we got a few questions for you. A little lightning round. We're going to zip through to wrap this thing up. Here's where I'm going to start, all right? I've read you're from Surrey, England, okay? And I'm very curious if you have a football club you support. I'm also a little bit nervous to hear which club it is. Which is it?
I'm a massive football fan, which you won't – it has nothing to do with where I live geographically.
Okay, good. Who's your
club? I'm a Liverpool fan. Liverpool. So the first game – there's a reason. The first game I ever went to watch was – my grandparents used to live in Leicester. Leicester is in the middle of the country. So my parents took me to a Leicester City game against Liverpool my dad and my grandfather in about 1970. I reckon it's about 79, probably. And we get into the stadium and they're Leicester fans. And I'm like, I like the team in red. And that was it. Now, at the time, Liverpool were really good, but I've been a Liverpool fan ever since. So that's why, from a Southern person who's a Scouser fan of Liverpool, but I'm a absolutely mental Liverpool fan. In fact, in Birmingham, there's a pub in Lee Branch called the Anvil, which is a Liverpool supporters club in Birmingham. So I was actually there on Sunday with my son, who's now a mad Liverpool fan. And I've got probably about 10 friends I've turned into Liverpool fans. So I've because everyone's so divided on Alabama and Auburn and then NFL teams. So I was like, well, we all need to have a team that we all pull for. So Liverpool, I'm a diehard Liverpool fan. We actually signed a pretty good centre-half.
I saw that. The kid from Wren. Kid from Wren, right? Yeah.
French guy, yeah. So it'd be good.
Who's your team? I've got my kids running around Tottenham jerseys, so I fear I'm scarring them for life the way it's going.
What's ironic is that is the best stadium in England. The London Stadium is unbelievable. And they have like every different concert. That's where you want to go. That is the best. But
although Old White Hart Lane, that was a classic. That was really good.
They've had some good players. Tottenham's a pretty cool club.
All right. So, okay. Next one, we're going back to golf. Gold, silver, bronze, your medal podium for golf instructors all time.
Oh, that's a great one. All right. So I would probably put, that's a great question. So if you went on pure resume, you would go on, like, for the best players, you'd probably go with Butch. If you went on the resume from taking someone from a junior to the number one in the world, it would be Randy Smith. And they'd probably they're different, but they're similar in a lot of ways. So those two are neck and neck. I think John Jacobs is an English guy who's a bit of a legend in the golf instruction world. So you'd have to sort of throw him in there. And then if you only can do three, I'd probably do those three just based on that. But I put Butch and Randy kind of like this just because of the skill sets. Butch is incredible at taking someone, he's historically taken these guys and made them unbelievable. Randy's done it on both sides. So it's pretty interesting.
There you go. Okay, now we know you moved to play golf at Southern Miss from England, and I'm just wondering, your favorite piece of Southern cuisine where you arrive at the States, you're like, what is this place? And you get served this, and you're like, I really love this food.
Oh, that's good. I'm a big fan of shrimp and grits. Oof, do like shrimp, yes. shrimp and grits. Well, we got married in New Orleans. My wife's family's from there, so anything that's Creole, Cajun food, I'm a big fan of Southern food. I like jambalaya. I like gumbos.
Gold
tigers. Yeah. LSU would be my second SEC team. I'm a big fan of Drago's charbroil and other charbroiled oysters.
Yeah, this is so good, man. Oh, man, this is so good.
So redfish is one of my favorite fish is probably redfish. Cook that all the time. I get that from Sexton's in Birmingham. Love redfish. So I guess any of that sort of Louisiana Southern cuisine. I'm not a massive fried chicken person. I'm just okay.
It's like Southern seafood. You got a brand. Yes, I like that. I love that
Southern Cajun seafood. Yeah,
very good.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, one more for you on the way out, right? And this could be a rough estimate, but I just want to know if you could guess how many times in your life you've been asked unsolicited to take a look at this.
Oh, I've lost count of that for sure.
And now, quick addendum. Did you lose count of that before or after you lost count of how many wins you had on tour?
No, I've definitely been asked, can you have a look at this, more times than I've won tour events. I can tell you that for sure. Perfect.
Probably in the worst places too. The worst would be, gosh, an airplane.
It's unbelievable. I'll tell you the funniest one. This is hilarious. So we're skiing. We're in Colorado skiing. And I'm not leaving any names out here, but we're at dinner at this nice chateau place, okay? And with some friends. And somebody comes up to the table, this grown human, and goes, you the golf guy? You the guy, the golf coach guy? And I'm like, I got no golf gear on. I mean, it's free. I got swear on. And my wife just looks at me, and I'm just like, and I never, you can't, you don't ever want to be rude to anybody. Like, and I'm like, I'm not sure. What do you mean? He goes, you are, aren't you? And then, and this guy just wouldn't leave. And I'm just like, and so these people, these stories about people going to doctors at tables and stuff, I'm like, yeah, people have no, it's for some reason, if it's golf, they're your best friend and there's no reason they shouldn't ask you anything. And I feel sorry for my wife. The funniest part is, people are always asking her, do you think Mark could help my father-in-law, or could Mark do this? And she, and I'm like, just, honey, I don't know what to tell you. So it's interesting. Like, if whatever is it, I guess it's like you're the village doctor. It's a free-for-all.
You see, just say, hey, grab a steak knife and I'll show you where your hands need to be. Create a little more depth in the backswing.
I've done plenty of those in restaurants with silverware and cutlery. I will say that. But yeah, it's people have no shame. I guess that's the best way to say it. I guess their golf games is just like anyone's business.
I can tell you, Charlie and I certainly have zero shame. We would have no problem. No problem.
Yeah, but it's the thing is, if it's people who you know are kind of in the business, I'm into it. I'll get all excited about it. But when it's somebody you don't know completely, you're like, really?
Yeah, come on. Go back there and eat your bread.
That's great.
All right, Charlie. Well, this has been a great conversation. Of course, if you want to learn more about Mark Blackburn, the way he coaches, I think this is a good place to start. I'm going to be starting on it tomorrow, the coaching code. I'm sure there's plenty of places to find it. I imagine Amazon would be a good spot to start.
Amazon or my website, blackburngolf.com, you can get it. Rosie wrote the foreword, actually, which is
beautiful.
Ironically, so
Yeah, right. Leave some notes in the margins for me, Smiley, when I get that copy from you. I want to have it highlighted, all the good spots.
I'll send you a copy too. That's not a problem. When I get back home, I can get you one.
Amazing. Mark, well, I appreciate you taking time. This has been an incredible conversation. Look forward to seeing you in Phoenix this week, and I'll see you definitely on the road. It's just our life these days, isn't it?
Appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
All right,
have a
Mark.
Good one.
See you, buddy. Thanks.
You know, I listen to this podcast. It's really cool. And
all of our first lovely time. Fans and subscribers, but make sure you like and subscribe.
It's cool to see what you guys are doing. I know golf fans appreciate it, but we do too, so please keep it up.
For all the good people of YouTube, like and subscribe.
You guys have some good takes, so I'm happy to come on and shoot the